intellectual discourse, critical thinking, to the downfall area. And we're an all-volunteer group. None of us are paid. We do it for our love of philosophy, right?
Yeah.
Right, Jack?
Exactly.
I want to thank everyone for coming out. We meet at the second and the fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. Any first-time visitors? We have a few. Okay. How'd you hear about us, sir?
Yeah.
Gentleman in the back?
I think somewhere on the internet or something.
Okay. All right, I've heard of that place. Okay. And ma'am, where did you hear about it? The Science and Religion Group? Okay, very good. Well, we're glad to have you. Anyone else? Yes, okay. How do you hear about us?
I happen to live very close to here,
okay.
And I was on Meetup, and I heard that we were having Dr. Alcott, so
wonderful.
I'm coming.
Okay, great. We're really glad to have you here.
Bob?
Yes?
David's grandchildren are here for the first time.
Oh, yes, David's grandchildren. Dr. Alcott's grandchildren and two or three of his kids and his lovely wife, Charlemagne, and we're delighted that you all are here. We've got some budding philosophers back there, I suspect. So if you haven't paid, please do so right now or immediately after lunch. Our treasurer, Jack Youngkin, so if you got in and you got by, we try to trick if you walk through without paying, but if we miss tricking you, then please pay after lecture. Cost is $5, which is a heck of a bargain to hear the caliber of speakers that we traditionally get. And a student with an ID is $2. If you want to be a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months worth of lectures. And then also, I want to remind you to pay for your meal afterwards. Sometimes people forget to pay, and then the Dallas Lecturers Forum is stuck with the bill. So we don't charge enough to pay bills for people's food as well. So anyway, we appreciate that. And then the spring schedule 2016, we've got two more lectures after this. We've got,
that's right.
Let's see, I don't have my schedule with me, but what have we got lined up, Jack? We've got, in 2 weeks, we've got, was it objectivity?
Plagiarism.
In defense of plagiarism.
So it's Dr. Rosenblum from the University of Dallas, and then the last meeting is May the 10th. It's Managing Polarities for Fun and Profit.
Right,
Managing Polarities. Dr. Farley from the Stegan Consulting.
Right. So then plagiarism. Who's pro-plagiarism out there?
My whole talk
is plagiarized. Okay. So our speaker, also, we've got a website with a lot of the same information out there. And it's www.philosophersforum.org. You can sign up on our email list. You can sign up for Meetup as well. So if you like it, please tell your friends and get them to come out here.
Okay.
And we always want to try and grow our attendees. So tonight our speaker will pontificate for 45 minutes and then open it up to questions, a short statement, and then so if you have a question, make a fairly short statement and then get to your question. And then also please turn off your cell phones or put them on pleasure mode or vibrate mode at this time. So our topic tonight is beauty, and our speaker is David Alcott, MD. We're very privileged to have Dr. Alcott with us tonight. Most of you know him. He's really a renaissance, true renaissance man, in my opinion. He received his MD from UT Southwestern here in Dallas and has practiced for over 40 years in the field of dermatology. 44 years, and you just retired. So he's an award-winning author. He's published books on poetry, a murder mystery grounded in philosophy called Fatal Philosophy, and the book cover's pretty cool. It's got like a knife in it in a guy's eye, right? And blood coming out of his eye. Yeah, he's got the Dallas Philosophy Forum in the book as well. The Self-Created Universe, a book integrating science with philosophy, and Requiem for Athens, a historical novel of ancient Athens. Dr. Elkick will be speaking tonight about the biologic, sociologic, and historic basis of beauty, And now please join me in welcoming Dr. David Helpcheck.
Too kind. Thank you. Can you hear me all right? Hear me all right in the back? Talk about plagiarism. My whole talk is plagiarized. No kidding. I used extensively a book, Nancy Edcoff, called Survival of the Prettiest. Yes, go on. Oh. Okay. So, what is beauty?
Me.
Bob, you're beautiful inside, Bob. Forget the outside. Okay, many intellectuals and pure scientists say that beauty is inconsequential. And since it has no meaning, then we have no place in intellectual discourse such as this one. But beauty rules in the real world. Not only in humans, but in animals. Turning a blind eye to beauty is like denying physical desire. Let's go to the first. Let's see, which is...
Which one's turned on for you?
Which one's
turned on? The right advances and left reverses.
Okay. Yeah. So turning a blind eye to beauty is like denying physical desire. Appearance is the most public part of ourself, and the world sees ourself or our outside, and it tends to, they think that it mirrors the inner self, you know, that we mirror what they see. This may not be fair, but it's the way the world works. So what is beauty? It has many definitions, but as the judge said about pornography, I know it when I see it. The ideal of beauty is in the mind, and it changes from time to time and from culture to culture, but there are certain universals. Clarity, symmetry, balance, or harmony of the whole, and color. The ability to perceive beauty and respond to it has been with us as long as we've been human beings. So the questions we should consider are, what is the biologic or evolutionary significance of beauty? Why do we value it? And why is it important socially? And that's what we're going to talk about. The argument for beauty as a biological adaptation is kind of familiar. Beautiful people are more likely to be healthy, free from disease or inherited abnormalities. Women who are young, fair, curvaceous, with a hip-to-waist ratio of approximately 0.7 or 0.8 are perceived more likely to be fertile, more likely to produce healthy offspring. For men, the size and muscular power, a masculine appearing face, are valued because they were once needed to obtain and defend resources. They're more likely to be successful hunters or warriors, fathers of healthy children, not only to sire them, but to protect and provide for them. You know, even 3 to 6 month old infants stare longer at photographs of attractive or beautiful pictures and attractive dolls, and even attractive strangers more than unattractive ones. The importance of beauty is not accidental or merely a cultural construct. Rather, survival of the species depends upon us accurately assessing a potential mate. Thus, beauty implies good health, and health ensures reproductive success. In the course of evolution, humans who noticed nice, clear skin, a lustrous, full of shiny hair, curved waists, symmetrical bodies and faces, desired those people to mate with and had more reproductive success. and we, ladies and gentlemen, are their descendants. It's therefore beauty is wired into us, wired into our brains by evolution. In fact, the brain recognizes three things immediately. Danger, food, and attractiveness. Think about it. On the other hand, ugly or deformed bodies, and especially the skin that shows abnormalities or eruptions, have negative value. Humans avoid them, ostracize them, even discriminate against them. Even the ancient Bible prescribes remedies for afflictions of the skin and the large area that's devoted to leprosy, and we're not even sure what that was or is, but the signs of it are on the skin. Okay, beauty is a bait, an attraction. Infants, like I said, 3 to 6 months of age are attracted to beautiful faces and gravitate to beauty. They have beauty detectors. That human faces may share some kind of universal features of beauty that even babies are attracted to. Likewise, adults are attracted to cute, beautiful babies. Why? We want to keep them. We don't want to. They may get on our nerves, but we want to keep them because they're so cute. Contrarily, premature or at-risk or deformed babies are less likely to be cared for. In fact, when studies of abused children were done, it was found that a disproportionate number of them were unattractive children. The evolutionary basis is that when humans are faced with limited resources, at-risk babies are less likely to survive. So in many societies, unhealthy or deformed babies were abandoned. Looks have always been a guide for us as to what is good and what is bad. Brown, dimpled vegetables or fruit or meat was unhealthy, was bad. So we tend to stay away from it. So likewise, ugliness was a sign of bad, mad, or dangerous people. Deformities and diseases were stigmas branded by the gods, by God, you know. And that even the Bible said that deformed persons were devoid of affection. Whether or not beautiful is good, beauty seems to bring out goodness in others. We react positively to it. In studies, people were more prone to return lost money to a good-looking woman than to a not-so-good-looking woman. A study was done by a sociologist and it put two women on the side of the road with flat tires. And you guessed it, the girl that was nicer looking, they stopped and repaired her tire faster. Good-looking people are more likely to win arguments, to persuade others, and to be elected. Persons are more likely to divulge secrets to them, to give them their personal information. However, we expect more from good-looking persons, everywhere from airline pilots to being good in bed. Expectations start in childhood. We expect attractive boys and girls to be more intelligent. Teachers that were shown pictures of students and their report cards judged that the nicer looking ones to be more intelligent, sociable, popular, even though the grades didn't say so, but they judged that the nicer looking ones were more intelligent. Good looking adults are more likely to get away with shoplifting, cheating on exams, avoiding a traffic ticket, even committing serious crimes like murder. This effect is particularly strong for beautiful women. What do we say? She could get away with murder. Literally. Beautiful people are thought to have better lives, happier marriages, more rewarding jobs. They're judged to be financially successful, to be kind, decent, and honest. In the sexual domain, we expect attractive people to be more popular, socially confident, sexually exciting, adventurous, experienced. And it turns out that good-looking men and women are more sexually experienced, begin to have sex earlier, and that good-looking men are more likely to bring their women to orgasm and to simultaneous orgasm. Okay, so let's see. What did I do? Ken?
Oh, it's, well, it should be. Where should he go? Okay. You gotta aim at that.
The social sexual advantages of beauty. What are they? They begin in adolescence. Adolescence is when those male and female bodies and faces start to change. They take on new shapes and colors and fat and muscle distribution. And for most of human history, humans mated in their teenage years. An anthropologist surveyed 554 traditional societies, cultures, and found that the average age for a bride was 12 to 15, and the average age for a groom was 18. And that's nowadays. Okay, adolescence is when we find out how potential mates respond to us. Teens are preoccupied with their bodies, theirs and others at this age, and are notoriously hypercritical of themselves, extremely attentive to their own attractiveness. And this doesn't end in adolescence. We're continually evaluated as mate material all our lives. And this is important not only in Western culture. A survey was done that showed that one-third of the inhabitants of non-Western and non-North American countries, one-third of place more importance on looks than the looks of their mates than did American college students. Men value looks more than women in virtually every culture. Physical beauty, like athletic skill, peaks young. So there are many efforts for beauty that are aimed to stretch those few years to make us look like a noodle adolescence for as long as possible. Women try desperately to hold on to those that youth, that look of youth. They want to appeal to men, of course, who seek younger partners. Beauty preferences are important in the real world. Nice-looking women tend to marry up, that is, to marry men with higher socioeconomic levels than they are. Either money or education, which translates into a better income. Good looks are a woman's asset, and exchangeable for social position, money, even love. Being with a good-looking woman also ups a man's status. He's thought to be more self-confident, intelligent, likable. He's got a trophy on his arm. There's also beauty envy. There are two reasons women care so much about beauty, about their looks. The first is men, the second, other women. Women are more competitive, more critical of other women and their looks than men are. The reason is female-to-female competition for those men, just as male-to-male competition for women. Why do both sexes care so much about the looks of their lovers, and why do men care more? The answer, you guessed it, three-letter word, sex. And the purpose of sex is reproduction. It's hardwired again genetically in our brains. A man may have no interest whatsoever in getting a woman pregnant, but, and he may take elaborate precautions against it, but his mate detectors are firing, and he may be turned on hotly by a woman who flashes the signs of her fertility, even though she may not be interested in getting pregnant at all either. But that psychology is there. It's burnt in. So how are money, rank, and power related to appearance? Boys form ranks quickly, even within an hour at a boys' camp. And usually the leader is not the biggest boy, but happens to be usually the nicest looking, most athletic, mainly mature physique. Not necessarily the biggest, but the nicest looking. And this is true later in life among leaders. At West Point, facial dominance had a big effect on military rank. Women value good financial prospects more than men in most cultures. Men with higher status, jobs and incomes are more likely to be married. Don King, who was the manager of Mike Tyson, said, any guy with $42 million looks like Clark Gable. athletes are another attraction for women. Basketball player Dennis Rodman said, the NBA is 50% sex and 50% money. Women practically audition. They're known to stand in line at the hotel when there's professional athletes or rock musicians and rock stars. Henry Kissinger said that, what going on, you? Henry Kissinger said, power is an aphrodisiac. It's well known that some politicians and presidents are notorious womanizers. Power, wealth, and status are magnets for women. Anthropologist John Townsend showed pictures of two men wearing a Burger King outfit, and the other was wearing a suit with a Rolex. And then he exchanged costumes with these guys and showed pictures to women. And the women were unwilling to date, have sex, or marry, even think about it, to the Burger King guy. But they were willing to entertain that for the guy with the suit and the Rolex. Clothes make the man, or better yet, status makes the man. Men are evaluated by their income and professional status as harshly as women are by their looks. And women with high financial income or security seek men with even higher, even more. And let me tell you that on a personal note, that being a professional, and especially a doctor, is an attraction. And some men are seduced by this and take advantage of it, and tragic consequences can be the result. This happens with not only professionals, with doctors, but with pastors, or religious men, psychiatrists, psychologists, other professionals that have a kind of a personal relationship with the opposite sex can be a trap. Beauty is also an advantage in the boardroom. Good-looking men are more likely to get hired at a higher salary and to be promoted sooner. And the same thing with women. However, that can backfire in a very, very pretty woman. It can be kind of a backfire. Good looks can backfire for a woman. It's the homely women who are truly disadvantaged economically. They're less likely to be hired, to earn competitively, to marry, and if they do marry, it's usually to a man with less financial future. Life's unfair and often cruel, but that's life. All of these facts drive men as well as women to the plastic surgeon or to the cosmetics counter to enhance what nature hasn't given us by nature or nurture to appear younger and more attractive. This is to be competitive for sex, but also for status, for power, and for income or money. Hopefully, these will bring happiness. But this doesn't necessarily follow, right, philosopher?
Right.
Happiness has more to do with qualities such as your self-esteem or sense of personal well-being or self-control, optimism, feelings of comfort with, and affection for people more than for looks or money. Let's see what we got here. Okay. What's the importance of skin and hair? We've been talking a little bit about that. The skin is the body's most aesthetic organ. It's a part of us that's visible. That's our social part. It's socially meaningful. Flawless skin is the most universally desired feature. And flowing, healthy hair is a close second. Our skin readily reveals and advertises our emotions, sweating, blanching, flushing, shivering. Likewise, when skin and hair are not healthy, they are repellent. We are indeed the naked ape. As you remember, Desmond Morris wrote a book by that name. Unique among primates, we are not covered by hair. This may have been an evolutionary advantage in hot climates, trying to outrun game for sweating and cooling. The naked skin, however, is both sensitive to the touch and serves as an erotic sign to the other sex. Hair on the body varies from very little in people in hot, dry climates to much more in cold climates. Women have less hair than men, and in many cultures try to remove what they have in order to accentuate that male-female difference. Men usually value long, lustrous, and lighter hair in the female. A woman's hair and skin tend to darken after their first pregnancy, thus changing that look of youth. And it's estimated that 40% of American women add blonde to their hair to look younger. Who said that? When a woman starts playing with her hair or flipping her hair, she's usually signaling sexual interest. Social scientists note that girls that show the typical triad of licking their lips, tossing their head, and flipping their hair are on the make. Hair has the whole sensory package: color, shine, texture, scent or perfume, and movement. In fact, hair is considered so sexually provocative that in many cultures, married women cover their heads, and in strict Muslim countries, all adult women cover their hair. For men, the head of hair is valued as more masculine, youthful, a sign of intelligence, leadership. In fact, some of the oldest records of the ancient papyri of Egypt had to do with regrowing men's hair. Alexander the Great proudly showed his golden curls in battle. Julius Caesar was so self-conscious of his baldness that he started a new style of combing the hair forward. That continued. Napoleon and Tsar Alexander in their historic meeting ended up talking about cures for baldness. Look at the commercials and the ads and the movies. The stronger actors have full heads of hair. Even balding actors are provided with hair pieces, as Sean Connery in his James Bond movies. Psychologists found that both sexes assumed that balding men were weaker and found them less attractive. Like me, I guess. It is for the purpose of attaining and maintaining that youthful, sexy appearance that in the U.S. we spend more than twice as much on care products and services than on reading material. See where our values are. Worldwide cosmetics and toiletries are a $50 billion with a B industry. Is this lavish spending a sign of too much time and money or of exploitative advertising? Not likely. The practice of decorating and enhancing our bodies has been with us for at least 40,000 years in the cave paintings, etc. And the British Museum is an Egyptian cosmetic box from around 1400 BCE, and shaving sets with bronze tweezers and razors from 2000 BCE. Egyptians had moisturizers, hair preparations, dyes, lip and cheek color, eye mascara, and of course wigs. In fact, the ancient Egyptians had most of the cosmetics that we have today. How we decorate and cover the body also has significance. Clothes have more to do than with keeping us warm. They denote rank or nobility. I mean, look at this silly thing that we wear. Gender, age, accomplishment, and in some cultures, tattoos and scarifications may serve these functions. Tattoos, scars, and piercings have additional meaning. They can be an initiation rite for adolescents or military men. Lovers can wear their tattooed name of their beloved. And since tattoos and scars and piercings are painful, and especially on tender areas, they denote strength and courage among the people who have them. This is much like the hunters or warriors or the German fraternity members who proudly wear their scars. Today, we have better science. We can do more than our ancestors with newer techniques and products such as Botox and Rogaine and lasers, cosmetic surgery, including hair transplantation. We're able to turn back the clock to obtain and keep a younger look. In fact, when I did hair transplantation, a lot of the men that came to me for it said, you know, I've got to keep up with my younger competition. I got to, you know, stay young looking. It's because this is not only important sexually, but financially, to obtain and retain that better paying job among competition. Men and women are starting plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery, and other techniques earlier and earlier, younger and younger. Now, you don't have to be rich for them. Many of the average is less than $50,000 a year of income. Okay, many factors motivate the decision for cosmetic surgery. There are external factors such as ethnic prejudice, age discrimination, coercion by a spouse or parent or boss, Internal motivators are usually emotional and include feelings of insecurity or not belonging to a group, unattractiveness, shame, social anxiety, even depression. I have personally treated many patients that had bad acne scars. They were depressed, some of them. And one patient in particular, after a successful dermabrasion for really bad acne scars, I mean, it just dramatically changed her whole personality. She became, you know, outward, where she was, you know, really socially depressed before. Many patients want to alter a physical feature they dislike, such as a big nose or bad teeth. Women desire a more youthful, sexually attractive look, whereas men are interested in having a strong look that facilitates their career, such as more hair or a stronger chin. And we humans, like other animals, signal more than just with our looks. For example, our voice, our inflection, timbre, loudness, and the words we use have emotional and very powerful communication. The adult male's voice, of course, is lower and louder because his vocal cords are thicker and wider than a woman's. Woman's voice tends to be breathier, softer, more tonal in inflection, etc. But voices, and like words, can be groomed, just like looks, and they can communicate a sexual desire or a turnoff or any range of emotions. Likewise, smell is another important factor. We know that very pleasant baby odor, that's just, we just love baby odor. In fact, they make artificial baby thing for our cars, right? The woman who loves to put on her man's t-shirt or sleep on his pillow, and the man who loves to, the smell of his beloved hair. Even the baby who buries his nose in his mother's clothes, mother's body. And we seek to enhance those with pure perfumes, deodorants, colognes, and lotions. Okay. Here we go again.
Pushing the right side.
Ah, there we go. Okay. What facial features define beauty? Nothing captures our attention or rival its power of communication like a beautiful face, like the human face. Our brain takes it all in, all the details, and makes a composite, makes a general impression which we notice as beauty almost automatically. Some of our features that identify our ancestry may have evolved due to climatic factors, such as our nose. Noses carry air to the lungs, and the air has to be warmed and moistened so that peoples who live in a northern or a very dry climate like the desert tend to have large noses, narrow noses, for that effect. Peoples who live in hot, humid climates such as Africa or South Asia tend to have shorter, broader, flatter noses. Eyes need extra protection against the sun. And so narrower eyes with a kind of a built-in padding or a built-in sunscreen, sunshade, and that's common in northern Asian peoples. Other aspects, such as eye color, hair color, texture, they have no biologic function, but they reflect the traits of the dominant individuals in the small communities from that they sprouted from. This is called genetic drift. You know, people ask me, you know, why do all Asians, you know, look alike? You know, why do they have, you know, they came from the same genes, and, you know, we all came out of Africa. It's called genetic drift or the founder effect. The dominant male in small communities had more mates and therefore more offspring that have his features. And so you have those offspring that they make offspring. It is geometric, okay? He has 100 offspring. Each of those have 100 offspring. Pretty soon they all look alike. There's some general agreement as to what is considered beautiful, since even three-month-olds seem to appreciate it. It turns out that people of the same culture tend to recognize what is beautiful, you know, for them. But also, transculturally, studies from the U.S., Europe, China, Japan, and India all show a significant agreement about what faces they consider beautiful. We tend to like the average. If you take a bunch of faces and you make a composite of it, people tend to like that composite, that average. Why? Because the average tends to be more healthy. If you think about, you know, the average fruit, the average this, the average, you know, it's not necessarily the most beautiful, but it's the composite, it's the average, and that's what attracts us. We're also attracted to others who look like ourselves. That's called assortative mating. They say, you know, gosh, they kind of look like they could be brother and sister. Women agree with men about which women are beautiful, and men agree among themselves and other women about which men are the handsomest. So, what are these ideal features that define beauty? Aha, there we go. Now you boys can wake up. Okay, so what are these ideal features about beauty? The female faces are universally judged and most attractive when they have, let's see, where's the
I don't think it's working.
Okay. Small chins. Delicate jawline. High foreheads. High arched brows. Prominent cheeks. Full lips. Prominent and wide-spaced eyes. When a makeup artist will do this woman, he tends to accentuate eyes, lips, and de-accentuate nose. Okay? Want the nose to kind of disappear. So that's why we color, you know, and really enhance those eyes and lips. And this extreme in models tends to give the appearance of a seven-year-old head on a mature body. If you just take this head, doesn't that look like a young kid? It does. It looks like a young kid. Cosmetic surgery and fillers enlarge women's lips, raise their brows, shrink their nose, enhance the cheeks to create human sex bombs. For men, the handsome male face. Okay, tends to be rectangular, okay, squared off. Nice, firm chin, square jaws, heavy brows, dark, sunken eyes, and of course, nice lips and hair. Hair, lustrous, thick hair is valued in men and women, both sexes. Let's see.
The batteries are getting low.
Come on, yes. Anyway, as cosmetic surgeons and dermatologists, we were taught that with age, you know this guy. Youthful fat pads, well, okay, here is him when he was a him. Nice, square, nice jaw, heavy brow, lots of hair, of course. And then this is him later. You're going to have to get a new machine.
I think we need that.
All right. This is him later. Older. Okay. His hair is receded. His eyebrows are a little thinner. But he's still, he's got that masculine look. And here she is. Okay, what have they done? Gave him a nice brow lift. Raised the eyebrows. Gave him some more lips. Thin the nose. But look at the jaw. The jaw is still a masculine chin and jaw. They didn't take that away. Okay. Let's see. All right. So what happens as we get older? We tend to lose these fat pads in the temple, around the eyes. The orbits become kind of sunken. This area here, that we call a tear trough, we lose that fat there. So what happens when this nice fat kind of goes away? Well, gravity takes its effect and pulls the superficial tissues down, and we get this accentuation of this nasolabial fold, these marionette lines, this what's called a pre-jowl sulcus here that kind of goes in right here. And in a real person, here we go, kind of shows this. What starts out as a nice triangle with the base at the top ends up, as we get older, with the reverse triangle with the base at the bottom. You can see it more here. See how her jowls and chin got heavier with gravity.
I don't know. Let me put some batteries in it.
Maybe it's your battery.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Okay, we'll show the man in just a minute.
Do you mean just, we'll just drag this on the
side here? Oh, we can do that.
Page down.
Here. Right. There you go. I'll tell you. Okay. All right. For the men, the same thing. And we see here more of this fat pad here becoming more prominent. It's not because that fat is increased, although it is here so. It's because he's lost this tear trough fat here around the eyes. And therefore, you get accentuation of this fold here called the nasolabial fold, and then this fold here called the marionette line, and then this little bump here called the pre-jowl sulcus, because of gravity pulling it down. Okay.
This will work now.
All right, and you know this person. And look what age has done to her. And I've seen her lately, and apparently she's had a facelift, because she doesn't look this bad now. But you can see what age does here. Pulls it down, and of course the neck is a telltale sign. And the backs of the hands are too. They show the photo aging, the spots, etc. But this shows what age is done. The little Botox will help this here. Okay. Okay, size matters. Two, tallness in the male makes them more sexually attractive. There's an unconscious association of height with status, power, leadership, and sexuality. Cadets who are elected to leadership tend to be taller, and so do executives and CEOs and political and military leaders. George Washington was over 6 feet tall. Okay, next one. Okay, I apologize that it kind of bordered the way I got it, but anyway, this one says the perfect female body according to women. And this is according to men. You can see how, we have this kind of slimmer body here. Although the pecs are pretty prominent, you have this nice big head of hair here. And the men tend to like broader, heavier shoulders here. The pectorals are the man's antlers, weapons of war. Let's see. Okay. Oh, yeah. All right. The most attractive male torso is this kind of V-shaped, you know, broader shoulders, narrower hips. What nature has not given us sometimes, we seek to enhance that with exercise and diet, or with cosmetic surgery, liposuction, high-tech remodeling, remolding, or implants. You know, listen, technology is going to constantly improve ways for us to improve ourselves. Okay, next one. Okay, here's the ideal female figure. Wake up, boys. All right. Long, lustrous hair, big boobs, nice, small waist, long legs. You know, in the U.S., breasts are a major focus in interest in males and females. There's a lower incidence of breastfeeding because that retains a more youthful breast, which may become large and ponderous or flat and elongated after childbearing. Human breasts, unlike other mammals, whose breasts become large when they're suckling their young. And when they don't produce milk, they shrink. Human females develop rounded breasts at puberty, and they stay that way, regardless whether they produce milk or not. In fact, breast size is not correlated with the amount of milk production at all. So what's their benefit besides being good looking? What's the benefit? Desmond Morris, in his book, The Naked Ape, theorized that when females wanted to develop a face-to-face bonding, they developed attractive things so the man would face her. And as humans developed this face-to-face bonding, the body evolved with attractors that met men's eyes. And sure enough, the women were successful. Men are still attracted to them. The ideal breast is the young, nulliparous females, that is, before she's had children. Once they're used for breastfeeding, they change shape and become less erotic. That's why during the Renaissance, when upper-class, wealthy women could afford wet nurses, they did that. And the décolleté, the plunging neckline, became more popular. Okay, during the Renaissance. That's what happened again in this country during the between 1940 and 1970 when bottle feeding and formulas became popular. And again, we had the sweater girl, the plunging neckline, that sort of thing became more popular again, as well as surgical enhancement. A psychologist examined men's perceptions of female body shape in 18 cultures and found that the waist to hip ratio of 0.7 was more important to them than breasts, or breast size, or weight even. Healthy young females tend to have more fat on their hips than on their abdomens. In Western African cultures, large buttocks in females was a desired trait, developing a shelf-like protuberance of the buttock posteriorly. This is known as steatopygia, literally fat tail. Translate that from Greek. Anyway, in our fat-phobic American culture, social status plays a factor. And overweight bodies have a definite negative value, especially for women. In our high carbohydrate fast food society, a third of us Americans are obese. We eat, then we spend more money on diet and exercise and surgery. Obesity researchers found a strong inverse correlation between status and weight in many developed countries. In other words, the higher your socioeconomic status, the less obese or less fat people were. This is more for women than for men. However, in the opposite is in developing countries where food is more scarce. In that case, overweight people, you know, that's their status symbol, you know, that they had more money and more food. So they tend to be heavier. Also, thin women are likely to marry up, that is to get men with higher social status, because those men like to choose thinner women. So let's get on with this. In conclusion, beauty is a core reality that's buried within all cultures and myths. Everywhere and at all times, it's been a powerful force provoking emotion, attention, action. Every culture and civilization has pursued it at enormous costs, sometimes with comic or tragic consequences. Helen of Troy, you know, Athena gave Paris that choice, you know, and he picked the most beautiful woman in the world as his prize. And the rest is history. To tell people not to take pleasure in beauty is like telling them not to enjoy food or sex or love. Our response to beauty is a trick of our brain. We've evolved genetically to increase our survival and reproduction. It's adapted to be attracted to potentially fertile and beautiful, healthy mates and helpless, irresistible babies. All men and women find clear, taut skin, lustrous hair, a woman's cinched waist, and a man's sculpted pectorals as attractive. Beauty is one of the ways our survival instincts perpetuate our species. It is rooted deeply in our biology. So beauty's not going anywhere. We are enslaved by it. Good looks tell us whether a person is potentially fertile, healthy, will produce good offspring, and provide for them. And this was true for the past 200,000 years. But in our modern world, we have to make a reality check. We could enjoy that moment of temporary thrill as a human being, as a human animal, but we must be aware of social norms and propriety. In other words, our brains can't help it, but we can. We gotta watch it. So what does the future hold? Beauty will likely increase in importance for both sexes. In our affluent society, with its striving for upward social status so important, there will be more and more search for and acceptance of beauty enhancement by surgical as well as non-surgical means. In the past, the state of the art technology was only in cosmetics and lotions and potions, and now we have all kinds of surgical techniques, tools, medications, cosmeceuticals, and perhaps in the future, genetic engineering. You know, we can make that beautiful baby, make that beautiful person. And this has nothing to do with morality. It is cultural, and it's driven by biology. Okay, our last one. So, the striving for beauty is innate and genetically driven. Therefore, the expenditure of time, energy, and money to attain and maintain beauty will continue. Thank you. There are some questions now?
Okay. I suspect that.
In the 20th century, Western cultures seem to have moved through a period of appreciating or being attracted to emaciated women. If you compare the women of the 20th century, the most attractive, they're a lot thinner, I think, than classically they were. And we seem to be, dare I say, growing out of that now.
Thank you for coming. My grandsons have to go. They have an exam tomorrow, so I excuse them. Thank you.
Any idea why?
Well, you know, it got to an extreme, and Twiggy, I don't know, Most people in here remember Twiggy. I mean, she was emaciated. She was anorexic to the point of having no breasts. You know, she looked like a 10-year-old, I guess. But that was going to a far extreme, and I think we've kind of bounced back, you know, from that. We enjoy a nice kind of padded person. Yeah. But it's cultural. It does. And that was a fashion. Fashions come and go.
I also remember from my experimental psychology classes that that people are attracted to other people who are at the same level of attractiveness that they are.
Yes.
So there's hope for the rest of us that are not Barbie doll or whatever. Because, you know, people that are not real attractive are not attractive to people like you were showing on the screen.
Well, yes, and I said that. Now we tend to be attracted to people that sort of look like us. That's called assortative mating. You know.
I kind of have a question. You didn't really touch so much about the history aspect of beauty. Why do you think the Nazis were so obsessed with beauty?
Why the what?
Do you think the Nazis were so obsessed with beauty? And then also, you mentioned about a lot of the actors and actresses are beautiful. But why do you think that their offspring are tend to be more likely to be born with autism and deformation?
The what?
A lot of actors and actresses in Hollywood, a lot of their children are being born with autism and mental disease. Why do you think that?
With oxygen?
Oxygen.
Let me answer the first one about the Nazis. Part of the Nazi philosophy was this racial thing, okay? That the Aryans were racially superior. But they weren't really Aryans. The Aryans were the Persians. But to them, you know, that racial thing was very important. That's why they wanted to kill the Jews and the Gypsies and anybody, and the Slavs, and anybody who wasn't, quote, Aryan. But that was part of that Nazi philosophy. It was racial.
You have a question? Aren't you giving me?
Right. I mean, the other question was that how you say how the people that are beautiful tend to have more offspring. Then why? I've read some studies where the so-called beautiful tend to be more polluted with disease, and their kids tend to be born with autism and deformation.
No, that's not true. That's a skewed study. I'm not familiar with that one. But if you look at the nice looking people around on the campus or people who are married, they tend to have normal kids. Autism is a rare thing that's kind of overdiagnosed nowadays. We don't know why it is, but it has nothing to do with the genetics or beautiful you know thing getting together like that. People in Hollywood tend to have fewer babies. it's the poor that have more babies.
Question here.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you have any pet ideas about why gentlemen prefer blondes, why people of both sexes prefer blue eyes.
Okay. The blonde I alluded to. That as you look at young people, they tend to have lighter hair, and then as they get older, the hair darkens. So darkening hair is a sign of aging, and so we want to reverse that process by lightening the hair. That's why 40% of women lighten their hair and or wear wigs with blonde hair. And I'm talking about all races, all colors. You know, Hispanics, black, they lighten their hair too. But it's because of that. They want to look younger. And what was the other part of that?
Blue eyes.
That's that Northern European thing. Like I say, you know, it has nothing to do with anything except, I want my kids to have blue eyes, you know, that sort of thing.
It's usually black hair and the combination of black hair and blue eyes.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
It's not just blonde with blue eyes. It's blue eyes with dark hair.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
That's supposed to be the beauty.
Yeah, maybe I can project. Okay. Now, we've all seen the statue of the beach in Iowa, and ladies will always tell me, petite ladies, which I think are very attractive, but they will say, well, I wish I had these big breasts. I said, the Venus de Milo was, wasn't that the Greek's idea of beauty? And that's, isn't she petite? And
no.
She was
wasn't petite.
She was voluptuous.
Yeah, she was pretty voluptuous. She had nice wide hips. And then you had Peter Paul Rubens, and his models were really kind of rotund. And so, you know, it goes through various cultures and various styles. The Greeks, Venus de Milo was a little later in Greek. I'll give you a little history of Greek art. That the height of Greek culture, classic art, was the male figure. The male figure was the beautiful figure. The female figure was draped. Always, it was never naked. But Venus de Milo, she's her breast show, but she's draped, you know, not naked at all.
Can I ask one more about the, you're talking about social culture status, shall we say. It seems to me lower status, the men really want the ladies to go get the, I don't know if you did breast implantation or not, but the breast implants, it seems like upper class, it's more of the athletic look, the girl, the more petite. Is that just my perception?
No, but I think that's our present trend in our culture for the women to be thinner, athletic, but to maintain their breasts. Men and women don't want flat, you know, breasts. And then if they've had children and they tend to get flat with age, they're going to have breast implants to really show them off. And, you know, the women among you can attest to that. I don't know if you've had breast implants, but that's the way the thing goes. Yeah, it's very popular. Yeah.
I am aware of, taken back by probably the current tattoo popularity.
Right.
I have no idea what these are going to look like when they are. I don't think it's people who get tattoos care. But this seems to be, I can understand all the other kind of cosmetics. You can wash them off at night. But the one that you can't wash off and stays with you forever, really, I don't know. I know it's popularity. I'm wondering, why on earth would they do
that? Again, it's fashion, and it's peer pressure. You know, my friend does it. Let's go as a group, and we'll get tattooed together. Of your and my generation, only Navy men had tattoos, et cetera, military men.
Carnies,
you know. Now, I remember going to Las Vegas about 10 years ago maybe. Saw this guy, young guy in his 20s, who had shaved his head, and he had a tattoo that went up his neck and into his scalp. It was horrible. And I said, what's he going to do when he's 30 or 40 and looking for a job? You know, who's going to hire him? Well, they don't think of it that way, you know. And we used to take off a lot of tattoos, and let me tell you, it's more painful and a lot more expensive to take one off than to put one off.
Last question.
David, I was just curious. With the Greeks and the Romans, or if you want, in your reading, and other cultures from the farthest of the past, has there been particular physical characteristics that, in your past reading about other societies, that were particularly predominant, like colors of eyes or the hair color? You could pick the Greeks, Romans, anything. Because these things are trends through the ages and different cultures, and not just with body weight, but sometimes eye color, right, and hair color, and complexion, how high the forehead is with women. Seems like I can remember during the Renaissance, it may be true, may be not true, but I remember reading gray eyes was particularly appealing in women. But I don't know.
know very many people with gray.
Okay. The civilization really started around the Mediterranean, and Mediterranean peoples tend to be olive skin, brown eyes, brown hair. Only as you got into the Alpine, you got a little lighter skin, and then the Nordic, which is the blonde, the blue eyes. You can't really change that. And Slavs, we got the name Slaves. So the Slavs, those blonde and blue-eyed, that were brought in as slaves. So they were looked down upon. I just wanted one little historical tidbit that you might be interested in. Alexander the Great made a style told his soldiers to shave their beards. Greeks before in the classic period, you see all the statues, they had beards. Aristotle, etc., had beards. He said, shave them because the enemy can grab them. So it became a style. And then the men shaved. All the Romans shaved. The earlier Romans had beards.
Okay, let's do another round of applause.